And we're live. Welcome back, everybody, to a new episode of the Wheelie Podcast. I'm your host, Micah Toll, and I'm joined again by Electrek Seth Weintraub. How's it going, Seth?
I'm good.
Awesome. And we have a bunch of new, interesting e-bike and e-bike related stories to cover this week. Everything from new e-bike launches from companies like Urban Aero, Angway, Bosch had a new announcement. We've got some new motors and batteries from Bosch. We're going to take a look at some new electric bike charging stations that are solar powered, a pretty neat off-grid solution. There's an interesting analysis on why fatalities from e-bike fires are actually reducing in New York City after a few years of rising, and a few other stories as well. But where are we going to start with this week, Seth?
All right, today we're starting with Bosch announces its new e-bike motor and bigger batteries.
Excellent. Yeah, it's always fun when Bosch comes out with something new because they're obviously such a major force in the electric bike motor drive industry. Now, this isn't totally new. It's really more of an update to one of their main battery lines. This is the Performance Line CX motor drive system, which people have probably seen on a ton of Bosch e-bikes out there. This is one of their nicer, higher end motors compared to their a bit lower power, a bit more economical active line, and some of the other older models. The new version here, it has a lot of what we've come to know and love from Bosch, but everything's just, a little bit better. They say it's a little bit quieter, a little bit more efficient. It's rated at 600 watts, which I think they didn't use to actually share the real peak watts with us. So it's nice to see that they're giving us sort of real numbers there, as opposed to what people have had to sort of figure out are the real numbers from like dyno tests and stuff. Now it's still obviously going to be a 250 watt motor classification. So what that means is that its continuous power is rated at 250 watts, and that will help it conform with all of the European regulations that require a maximum of 250 continuous watts. But what the peak power tells us is, what is the power that you're actually feeling? When you really push on the pedals, when you're in the highest power mode, what's that like seat of the pants feel? And so 600 watts is definitely, on the higher end. It's not gonna, match a 750 watt motor like we're allowed in North America, or at least in the United States. I think Canada might still be 500 watts, but it's definitely gonna be up there and starting to challenge some of the Asian mid-drive makers that don't have to play by the same European rules. So that's definitely nice to see. On the torque side, I believe it's 80 or 85 newton meters of torque, if I'm not mistaken. So,
Eighty-five.
this is a very, yeah, 85. There we go. Thanks, Seth. Yeah, so very torquey motor. This is obviously designed for mountain bikes and other bikes that really need that extra torque for when you're climbing up steep inclines, that sort of thing. Of course, Bosch is going to use a torque sensor, but in this case, like some of Bosch's other motors, we've got a nice mix of sensors. So there's the torque sensor, there's a cadence sensor, there's an inertial sensor. I assume there's probably still a speed sensor somewhere, whether it's on the wheel or inside the motor, or perhaps embedded into the chainstay. But it's a pretty sophisticated suite of sensors there that they use, all working together to decide how to apply that pedal assist, which is obviously one of the big differentiators between motor makers, because at a certain point, everyone's using kind of the same magnets, everyone's using basically the same copper wire. And so it's that programming that goes into how that power is delivered, which makes a big difference. And so that's a big part of the Bosch system is how they've designed it to all work together. So it's great to see that as well. But it's not just the new Bosch Performance Line CX motor that they announced in this unveiling. There's also a set of new batteries. It's the new PowerTube 600 and 800 batteries. And the 800 is, I believe, the biggest battery that Bosch has made so far. At 800 watt hours, that's getting up there with the juiced 4820 batteries that they make that are like 960 watt hours or so. So we're not quite there, but for Bosch, that's a big deal. I think previously the highest was 700, if I'm not mistaken. So another big jump here. And these are also the internal batteries. These are the ones that are designed to fit down inside the frame, which is very nice to see. generally there's going to be some sort of panel on one side, so it does drop out. But these are not like, you know, the Bosch batteries we often see that are just bolted onto the outside of the frame. These are those nicely integrated ones that different frame makers can sort of incorporate in different ways into their bikes, whether they're top loading, bottom loading, etc. So it's definitely nice to see Bosch pushing the capacity up a bit, because when you get into these powerful mountain bikes, that's where you really want to have that extra bit of range there. You know, if you're just talking about a commuter, a more efficient bike, that sort of thing, at a certain point, you know, 500-600 watt hours is going to be enough. But when you get into the dirt, especially if you're climbing hills, that sort of thing, those are the situations where, you know, an extra 100 or 200 watt hours can really make the difference between being able to stay out for an extra hour kind of thing. So that's definitely nice to see. And then the last thing is they have that PowerMore 250 battery, which you can also add on. It basically is shaped like a water bottle, which a lot of companies have, and it just goes in the water bottle cage, and you can add 250 extra watt hours. So it's nice to see Bosch, you know, keeping up, unveiling new products, both pushing more power, nicer upgrades, more efficient motors, and giving more options for the battery capacity. Of course, you know, they're still updating. They're still keeping their lower capacity batteries up to date, as evidenced by that new PowerTube 600. But it's always cool to see them, you know, expanding into either power or capacity areas that they haven't been yet. So to see 800 watt hours is nice for me. I know you do more mountain biking than I do, Seth. What do you think about these improvements?
That's great. I mean, obviously, Bosch is seeing competition on the specs piece from, you know, Bafang and, you know, the other Chinese automaker, or sorry, bike makers. So it's, you know, like Bosch is never going to win the specs race, right? They're, you know, Bafang's, you know, they have the Ultra's got more than 2 kilowatts of power if you get the right controller. So they're not going to ever beat that. But you get so much more with Bosch, the whole system. You mentioned like all the sensor suite. Everything's dialed in so much more with Bosch stuff. So they are, I guess I would say, I don't want to say conceding, but like they are acknowledging the desire for more power out there. You know, in the, I don't want to say just in the North American market, because this is obviously a global thing. Mountain bikes are used off road. So there's not kind of the, you know, 250 watt ceiling that most European countries kind of enforce. You know, that's 500 watts in Canada, 750 watts in the US. I mean, this line could be used in a US street bike thing, and nobody would bat an eye. The other thing with Bosch is like they don't have throttles, so you're not really getting all that power like all at once. Obviously, you're getting in addition to your pedaling, which is fantastic for fitness, fantastic if you're, you know, a cycling enthusiast. But for those who kind of just want to throttle around, that's not something Bosch is like, that's just not their thing. So, you know, the 600, the higher power, as you said, means you need more battery to kind of keep that on the trails longer. So it makes sense that as they're upping the power, they're also giving new batteries. 800 watt hours seems fine for a pedal assist bike. It seems actually pretty impressive. And then, you know, the PowerMore 250 extra, that puts you over a kilowatt hour of battery. So hard to complain about that. The other thing, the one thing I'm not fully on board with is that the Purion 400 display, kind of small for those of us with reading glasses, not always helpful. The bigger screens are sometimes nice, you know, especially with that, you know, like you don't need every piece of information, but like those pieces of information that are really tiny are pretty much invisible to me when I'm riding. So obviously you can throw your phone on the bike as well and use the Bosch app. So I don't know. All this stuff together is a nice yearly upgrade for mountain bikers. I think it's, you know, with Bosch owning what 50%, I would say, of the or more of the high end e-bike market. I think this will be a nice addition to a lot of mountain bikes out there. Do we have any early adopters that we know about?
I'm not sure which bikes are going to be using this yet. I'm sure, you know, all of the new flagship electric mountain bikes that use Bosch's system are going to jump to this right away, but I haven't heard of any specific ones yet.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll look forward to it. I can't wait to try it out.
Definitely.
All right. Let's move on. Urban Aero launches updated Bosch-powered electric cargo bikes in the U.S.
Yeah, speaking of Bosch, so Urban Aero is, I believe it's a British-based cargo bike brand, if I'm not mistaken. I think they're based in England, and they make really high-end front-loading cargo bikes. So front loaders are those ones that look like they have a bathtub on the front of the bike. And so instead of having your handlebars go straight down into the front fork, you've got this big old tub in front of you. And then the front wheel is way out in front. So if you've never ridden one, the first time you hop on it, it takes a few minutes to sort of get used to like the point of steering in the front not being right below your hands. But they're actually super convenient for when you're taking, especially kids around, but also for any sort of cargo, because it not only does it hold it lower, so it keeps the center of gravity nice and low, but if you've got kids in there, then you can actually watch them and, you know, have more interaction with them while you're riding, as opposed to having them behind you where, you know, you got to keep turning to look around to make sure they're not, you know, hopping out or fighting or throwing things or whatever kids do, I'm told. And so to me, it's like a really convenient design for cargo bikes. And it's exciting to see Urban Aero launching their newest cargo bike in the US, because I feel like the US is the next big market for these things. You know, in Europe, they're widely adopted. It's kind of like the role of a minivan in the US. Like families just know that if you got, you know, a kid or maybe two or three kids at this point, it's time to upgrade to a cargo bike kind of thing. But these really nice cargo bikes just are at the very beginning of breaking through in the US. It's funny because I remember a few years ago when I was living in Boston, or actually in Cambridge, north of Boston, I was starting to see these bikes. And that seems like the area that is sort of the most like Euro liberal pocket kind of thing where these would be popular. So, you know, it was funny to see these like Dutch style front loader cargo bikes in Cambridge, in Massachusetts, but I can see them starting to spread out in other cities. And, you know, Urban Aero is obviously a leader in this specific style. There are other companies that make them, you know, Riese & Müller has, Yuba has, lots of company. I think even Tenway has a front loader now. But Urban Aero is really known for these. And so it's nice to see this new one come to the US here. It does make use of a lot of Bosch's nice features. You know, you've got the built-in GPS tracking, that sort of thing, which is important with these expensive cargo bikes. You know, I should point out these, depending on the model, they're somewhere between $6,000 to $7,000. So this is a significant investment, right? This is not your like direct-to-consumer $1,699 cargo bike. This is a very expensive, like family vehicle type of cargo bike. So, you know, to have the higher end components, to have the GPS tracking, that sort of thing is a big deal. It is nice to see that Urban Aero does have two versions here. One has the belt drive, using Gates belt drive, some slightly nicer components. And so that one is the $7,000 one, I believe. And then there's a $6,000 version that has, you know, slightly lower components. I think it's got a Shimano drivetrain. But all the important stuff, you know, the brakes, the tires, the kid carrying box, all that stuff is pretty much the same from one to the other. So it's really more talking about the components here. But, you know, to me, this is just like the perfect way to move a family with small kids around. Once you get too big, it's, you know, it's a bit tricky. I've ridden these before with my wife in the front. And you can really only fit like one adult in these. You see them often with like two, three, four children, but one adult, I think is probably the max. Seth, we've tried riding these together a few times, right?
I was just going to mention, I feel like at a few bike shows, we've traded places in these things. And it, you know, it's a nice ride. Like it's kind of nice not to have to pedal sometimes and just enjoy the trip. The low center of gravity kind of keeps the balance pretty well. You can see that there's that big kickstand thing that, you know, allows you to load the kids in and out without having to worry about the bike flipping over or anything. So I love these things, but like until there's like bike lanes that are guarded, like in the US, which is rare, I feel like these are going to be stunted. Like they're just not, like people just don't feel safe enough on US roads for the most part. I'm generalizing here, but I kind of feel like we're going to never be as fully adopted as, you know, the Dutch or even other places in Europe where these things are everywhere. Because there's just that fear that a car is just going to come barreling through, you know, the painted bike lane stripe. Like, so it's one of those things where, you know, we say we have bike infrastructure by painting a line on the side of the road that and putting a bike logo there. But I don't know that if I had two young, you know, 2-3-year-old kids, I would feel safe in that situation. So my feeling is that, yes, these things are great. Yes, you know, they're a little pricey, but like, you know, people spend that much on strollers. So you know, a bike isn't that big of a stretch for me. And obviously this, you can go a lot farther and faster and more comfortable. So I like it. I just, I think in the US we're going to have a slower adoption curve because of our lack of infrastructure, like real bike infrastructure.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you actually. I know like your kids are teens now, so you're a bit past this, but let's say when they were, you know, of toddler age or whatever age you would, you know, ride kids around in this, what would it take for you to feel comfortable like taking them to school in this, for example, like a painted bike lane, probably not ideal, you know, a separate bike lane, bicycle, pathways. Like when I was in Cambridge for a year, I would see people using these on what were like basically, you know, 5-foot wide pavement paths that just cut through parks and stuff designed for bicycles. They weren't even on the road. Like, what would it take you to feel comfortable taking your kids?
Yeah. I mean, that's perfect. And I'm probably a bad example because, I had a bike seat in the back and I would take my kids like everywhere. But
I think that's a great example.
Well, yeah, but I'm not like a litmus test of
fair enough.
People. But yes, I would feel way more comfortable on a dedicated bike path or even one on the side of the road that had some sort of barrier, you know, a curb barrier. I think that's kind of like, those are table stakes in bike infrastructure. It's like, you got to put something hard up so that when a car just, you know, somebody's like texting and they just start coming over to the side. I mean, there's all kinds of deaths all the time. You know, we cover bikes. I see the news, like, you know, somebody in Albany just like a couple of weeks ago died because somebody was, you know, in their pickup truck and they didn't, you know, they weren't watching the road and they just came over and they killed them. And it's like, oh, that's murder. No, that's actually just a mistake and poor guy and whatever. So I don't love the bike lanes that are just paint. I feel like, with the way people drive, I think we need curbs. Anyway, so to your original question, I would totally use one of these, even in even without bike lanes, I would use one of these. But I'm, again, not a good litmus test for that.
And one thing I think that is important to point out is that they do actually have, I think, 4-point harnesses in there for the kids. Yep. And they seem to be pretty well designed in terms of safety. Obviously, you know, it's not a car with crumple zones and such, but it does seem like they've put a lot of thought and effort into making that front cargo box as safe as it can be.
Yep. I agree. All right. Let's move on. New low cost electric cargo bike promises 200 plus mile range and fast charging. Well, I know the 200 plus mile range thing we've heard before. So
yeah, so This is sort of on the other end of electric cargo bikes. This is from a company called Angway, which is pretty representative of a lot of these Asian-based direct-to-consumer companies that have sort of a U.S. Front to the company that, you know, they keep a U.S. warehouse and they ship from the U.S., but most of the, you know, operations, the customer service and everything comes from some Asian headquarters. And so they're pretty representative of this like $1,400 to $1,800 electric cargo bike, direct to consumer type company. Their newest model here, this is the LE20, claims a kind of crazy sounding 217 miles. And this is one of those cases where it's not totally bogus, but it's under very specific scenarios, can this be possibly achieved? And basically what this comes down to is battery capacity and how you ride the bike. There are two battery options here, and the one that is supposed to give this crazy mileage is the one that comes with two 48-volt, 19.2 amp hour batteries. So you're talking about close to 2 kilowatt hours of capacity. If you ride that in the lowest pedal assist level, that would get you around 8 watt hours per mile, which does get you close to 200 and some odd miles of range. So it's not like false advertising, but it is unlikely that most people will ride a bike like this heavy in the lowest power level and be able to do it for like 15 hours or whatever it would take to get, 200 miles on this thing. So, they're definitely not lying, but you got to understand what it would take for you to achieve that. So sort of crazy range rating aside, it does seem like another interesting sort of stretched rad runner-esque addition to the market here, the Angway LE20. One thing that I do like about it that we don't see in a lot of these utility bikes is it does come with these cast rims. Basically, instead of having spokes on the wheels, you have six or eight or however many they do here. I think it's six cast, usually from magnesium wheel rims. And that just means you never have to worry about spokes breaking, spokes loosening up, the wheel becoming untrue, that sort of thing. For a lot of people, that's a big advantage because it just removes one more maintenance thing. I feel like it used to be a little bit more important. Now spokes have gotten better, especially on e-bikes. Companies are using heavier gauge spokes and it's less of an issue. 10 years ago, I used to work in an e-bike shop and people would come in with like 10 out of their 36 spokes broken around a hub motor because a lot of companies were using the same spokes you'd use on a non-electric bike, and you just start ripping those spokes out after a year or so. So, it's not as big a deal now, but I do like to see that. You give up some weight savings there. They are a bit heavier, but they're just really strong and really nice for maintenance. Another cool thing is that the company offers a pretty high power charger here, 8 amps, which is usually, 2 to 3 times faster than a lot of the 2 to 3 amp chargers that you'll see with most direct to consumer Chinese e-bikes. So, there are a few things on this bike that do set it apart, but for the most part, it's pretty much just a mid-tail, fairly powerful utility bike of the Rad Runner style that we've seen a lot of these. Nowadays there are so many, I'm not sure if it's even fair to, call it Rad Runner style. Though Rad did kind of set that category in motion when they launched the Rad Runner. And so I think it is an interesting one to have in the market here. And it's also priced fairly well. It launches at a $1,499 early bird price. Now it may bump up, $100 or $200 eventually, though a lot of these companies end up just sticking with these prices because it's hard to raise the price and lose out on those sales afterwards. So for $1,500, you're talking about a super long range, class 3, 28 mile per hour, fairly powerful, 1300 watt peak rated e-bike here. Now Angway is not, they're not known to have the same type of component level or service level as the higher end companies. This is definitely not an Urban Aero like we just talked about. It's not a Turn. It's not a Trek. You're not going to be able to get this in like a bike shop kind of situation. This is direct to consumer, so you got to know that going in. But we've reviewed a few of these Angways, and as a low cost, easy to work on bike, it's definitely up there among the more entry level companies. I don't know if I would recommend it over like electric or something, just because you know with a company like Lectric or Rad that you've got a local customer support team in the US. You know, like you can email them, you can, you know, chat them on your time zone. You don't have to wait for answers, that sort of thing. But I am glad to see more entries like this in the market. What do you think, Seth? Something special or just sort of like another Radrunner type bike?
Well, I mean, there's plenty of those out there. I think where this thing is going to come in nicely is that they're probably like it's $14.99 now. They may raise the price. I doubt it. But I've seen Engways come, you know, I've seen Engways below $1,000 before. So I think this is likely to come down in price over the next few months. And this will be like kind of the lowest priced cargo bike you can get. The $14.99 price, does that include both batteries or is that a one battery option right there?
It's a good point. That might just be the single battery to begin with, though it's still
Okay.
almost 1,000 watt hours, so it's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's still plenty. The other thing is Engways often come, or I've seen them quite a bit with the extra battery at a still very, like a very low price. So, you know, I think when you look at the spectrum of bike options, this is going to be the most bang for your buck, but a little bit more risk in that, you know, as you mentioned, very little service, very little local support. But the company's been in business for a while. They've been selling bikes. We reviewed them. They're solid. The components are, you know, mid-tier at best, but you know, what you get here is a pretty good package, and obviously there's some fun accessories as well. So, you know, if you're the kind of person who feels comfortable with a bike that may not be supported super well or may have medium level components, I think this is probably going to be a good price point for many. You mentioned the electric option, probably for the price and for the, you know, the better support and the local company thing. They're based in Phoenix, I believe, right?
Yeah, electric. Yeah.
That might be a better option. So, you know, it's good to have this out there. This will probably be on Amazon in, I would say, 5 or 6 months at around $1,000. That would be my guess.
Yeah, if this was $1,000, it would be a pretty tough deal to pass up.
Right. Yeah, I let's see what happens. All right. Moving on. New off-grid solar-powered device can charge 12 electric bikes.
This one's pretty cool. It's from a company called Beam Global. They just unveiled it a couple days ago. Now, these are renderings we're looking at if you're watching the podcast video here with us. So I'm not sure they actually have a functional installed solar-powered bike charging station like the ones that we're looking at, but this is the product that they're intending to roll out. It has, I think it's 4.4 kilowatts of solar panels in a canopy that covers the parking area. And then there are 12 parking spots that basically look like a bike rack, but each one has a 120 volt AC outlet on it. And so what that means is not only can you know, roll up and lock to it as secure parking, but if you bring your charger with you, then you can plug in and get a charge for as long as you're parked there. So for a lot of people who maybe let's say this is on like a school campus or something, if you come in for, you know, an hour long class, you get there 15 minutes early, you leave a little bit after, you can get almost an hour and a half of charging, which is probably going to get you know, 30, 40, almost 50% of your battery charged, depending on how big your e-bike battery is and the size of your charger. Now this thing does have its own internal battery. And so it's going to work even when the sun's not shining. I think they have 20, 30, and 40 kilowatt hour battery options, so different sizes. And it's, you know, going to obviously generate its own energy while the sun is out, but that means it can be installed in places that are far from an electrical hookup, and it's easy for campuses or organizations to install it somewhere that they don't need to have, you know, an electrician come in and tie it into the grid power. I'm not entirely sure what the business model is here exactly, because e-bikes use so little energy while charging that I can't imagine it would ever be profitable to offer charging as a service and you know, try to make money off of that. I mean, you're talking about like 15 cents of electricity per charge. Like there's just no way to make money on the charging itself. But if Beam is, you know, basically offering this as a product that companies can buy, let's say Google wants to make it really easy for people to, you know, park their e-bikes and charge them outdoors while they're on the Google campus, then perhaps, you know, there's something to be said for having this as like a turnkey solution that malls or universities or, you know, companies or you know, local parks and recreation departments can buy and just set up very easily, basically anywhere, because it doesn't have to tap into local power, because it's basically a turnkey off-grid solution. So I think it could be a really interesting addition. Now, we don't know how much it's going to cost, you know, for the whole package. Ideally, you know, you're not being charged money to charge there, because again, like it's, you know, you're talking about like pennies here worth of electricity. But the only other sort of criticism of this setup, which we've definitely heard of a lot, is that these, you know, 120 volt outlets, it's great to have them as an option, but it means you have to bring your wall charger with you, right? Like there's no standardization in e-bike charging. So it's not like a car charger where you just have like a J1772 or an NACS plug. Here you've got to bring your charger because there's like a dozen different e-bike charging plugs and there's different voltages. Because this is DC, so if you've got a Bosch system, you're on 36. Most other e-bikes are on 48 or 52. That's really limited, because if you don't want to travel around with this big brick in your bag, there's no other way to charge. The other thing is you have to find a way to lock your charger while you're there if you don't want to take a chance of someone just walking by and stealing your charger, which actually had happened once when I was using a public outlet, actually for my rickshaw tricycle. Someone just stole my charger because I hadn't locked it. It was in a parking garage, but still there was, you know, nothing to keep someone from just walking by and unplugging my tricycle and going off with the charger. So you'd have to have some sort of locking box, or I've seen people put the cable of their charger through like a nut or some other sort of round metal thing. Yeah, and put a cable through that. Theoretically, you could just cut the cable and solder it back together, but you know, that is going to stop most people, I would say. But it's a cool for locking.
Well, just I guess we got to standardize on a charging mechanism, right? Some kind of,
yeah, I mean, good luck with that,
right?
I mean, you got to standardize on like a voltage, DC thing, because like
the solar is DC, so you got to invert it, you know, to AC and then back, or rectify it. And so that's, you're losing some power there. Not a big deal with e-bikes. I think it's pretty small amount of power you would be losing. But it's kind of like, you know, as you mentioned, it's a hassle that like you got to carry around your brick. I wonder if like integrating, like what if bikes started integrating the charger into the bike, where you would just plug in to it.
So that would be ideal, where all you have to do is plug in basically an extension cord. I mean, that's the way electric cars work theoretically, right? Like the charger's mostly on board, yeah. and a J1772 is just a fancy extension cord, right? So I mean, that would be ideal. The problem is that these e-bike chargers are generally fairly fragile electronics. They're not meant to bounce around the way a bike is. I mean, you could solve that, because there's a lot of electronics in an e-bike that are ruggedized, you know, the speed controller and
such. But then you get more expensive, heavier, like all those things that you don't really want.
Yeah, exactly. And there are some e-bikes that actually have the charger built in. That company in Newport Beach, electric bike company, that they build their bikes there. They have one model of battery that has like, you know, the old vacuums that have the like spool AC cord that come out of them. They've got that built into the bike, and you know, unspool it and plug in. So it's been done. It's not unheard of. It's just very uncommon.
Right. Yeah. It's like, well, like let's see where we're going. I mean, I guess 48 volt would kind of seem like the right area of DC if you're going to have like a DC adapter, right? Like, you don't really need it. I mean, there's 72 volt stuff out there for, you know, the Surons, but 48 volt seems to be pretty good. I mean, there's some 52 volt things, but is there a 48 volt DC like standard? Is somewhere someone like, you know, just is a generic barrel thing the way to go? Or, I mean, Bosch has this weird crazy thing, and then there's the magnet stuff, and
yeah, I mean, that's the problem, is there's so many. I mean, you're right. So the 5.5 by 2.1 millimeter barrel is like the plurality, I would say. But even that is probably, you know, maybe 30 to 40% of bikes total. I mean, I think, it, you know, most of the cheaper bikes will use it. But then, like you're saying, when you include like the Broza and the Bosch and all those others, they often have those fancier connectors. And then Bosch, I believe, is a 36 volt architecture. So then you got to have a, you know, a different voltage for those. And oh, it's a mess.
Yeah. I don't know what the answer is, unfortunately. I guess the answer is this, right? This is the best we can
do. I mean, this is the most effective solution right now, for sure. And that it gets the job done. But if you look at, so I guess the best example of this being done in bulk would be in China, where you have these types of street level 120 volt AC outlets all over the place. The difference there is that there's no theft of chargers because of like a societal differences, where partly the extreme surveillance with so many cameras in the cities, but also like just this like sort of, I don't know if it's more respect for personal property or what, but like people just leave their chargers sitting on their bikes in China charging and no one steals it. So maybe it, you know, it works there and it demonstrates that the concept works, but it totally depends on the people you're surrounded with. And if it's an area where someone's going to jack your charger, then you got to have some sort of lockbox or something.
Yeah. It's a conundrum. You know, the other thing, the one last thing I would mention is that city bikes in New York and some of the other municipal bike systems, I think Vélib' as well in France and Paris, they have as part of their connecting mechanism a charging thing. And maybe that's the end game, is like, you know, you have a just like a universal like locking and charging mechanism that, you know, you can add to your bike, for instance. Maybe, you know, it's not something that comes standard, but if you live in a city and you want to use this charging system that exists already, maybe you can do something like that. You know, obviously there's a lot of things to think about there, but maybe if the cities and the Vélib' of the world open their racks up to third parties, maybe that would be an answer. Or if they commoditize their charging infrastructure, it would make sense.
Definitely.
All right, let's move on. E-bike fire deaths are plummeting in New York City, and here's the real reason why. Good to hear.
Yeah, this one is interesting to me because, you know, we've been hearing more and more about electric bicycle battery fires in the news. It's somewhat overreported, in my opinion, just based on the sheer number. But, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And so a lot of places report on these. But interestingly, despite sort of New York City being known as the epicenter because of just how many e-bikes there are there, and especially some of these, you know, more lower cost budget e-bikes used by all the delivery riders. But despite there being more e-bikes than ever on New York streets, this year, we've actually seen a big drop in e-bike battery fire fatalities. 2023, there were 14 fatalities. And so far in 2024, there have only been 4. Now, we still have 3 months left, but, you know, we're on track for a significant reduction, which is great news. But it begs the question, why? Like, how did that turn around? Now, with this small of a number, it's potentially into, you know, sample size bias and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, there have been some major differences this year that can contribute to this very promising trend. First of all, we're well into New York City's ban on non-UL listed batteries. And so what that means is that New York City basically stops at the border any e-bikes that don't meet UL, or I think they expanded it to some other, you know, like SGS and other internationally recognized battery testing standards. And so that prevents a lot of those super, super cheap batteries from coming in that were popular among, you know, lower income, especially these delivery riders, you know, not to single them out in any unfair way. I certainly understand that when your livelihood is riding your bike around, delivering, you know, packages or food all day, that, you know, every dollar counts and it's important to save money where you can. But it was those super cheap batteries that were often produced by, you know, unscrupulous factories that were cutting corners on safety. And so that's helped get a lot of those out. New York City's also had a really big educational push on trying to get people to not charge their batteries, you know, indoors, under their bed, in their living room, that sort of thing. Not only has there been this educational push, but the city has also installed a number of outdoor charging areas, not quite as fancy as the Beam, you know, solar powered outdoor charging that we saw just a few minutes ago in that that new product. But we've seen a number of these cabinet style, kind of like the Gogoro cabinets, but, you know, a little more sort of like electrical box looking. Usually they're enclosed and their little door opens up and you can put a battery in and either charge it off of a DC plug that's already correct for that battery, or a situation where there's just 120 volt AC outlet and you can lock your charger in that box with the battery. There have been several of those installed. There are two companies that I think New York City has been working with on those. One is called Swabee, S-W-O-B-B-E-E. It's a, I think it's a German company, if I'm not mistaken. They're active all over Europe, I believe in South America as well. And so it's cool to see New York City working with them on this pilot to test those charging cabinets. There's another, I want to say it's called Pop Wheels or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, New York City's, you know, they're not only like dancing with one partner here, they're trying out a lot of solutions to try and find ways to, you know, help people charge outdoors and not, you know, put themselves in a situation where if there is a battery fire, that it's more likely to lead to injuries or deaths. New York City has also stepped up enforcement of these bike shops and especially battery repair shops, which were a major contributor to some of these fires, because with so many e-bikes out there on the streets, eventually, you know, batteries are going to break and there are going to be people looking to get these things repaired. But if a repair shop is, you know, not operating with the right tools or they don't have the right training, then it can be very dangerous to open up these batteries and start poking around without the necessary experience or knowledge. So I think I've heard of something like 250 plus inspections that the city inspectors and the fire department has made to battery shops and bike shops in the city this year so far. So, you know, they're not just paying lip service to this issue. They're really, you know, sort of tackling this from many different aspects, from regulatory to enforcement to education to providing the resources to allow people to charge in safer locations. So from all these different aspects, it's really great to see that the efforts that the city has put into this seem to be, you know, really, really paying off in the reduced number of injuries and deaths. Though it's important to repeat that, you know, this is a very small number to begin with. You know, talking about 14 deaths last year and three so far here. I think the figure that I often point out here is that you're like three times more likely to die from choking and five times more likely to die on the subway in New York City. So keep that in
mind. Yeah, so I was going to have a contrarian point of view on this. I also think it's overreported, but I think some of the scare tactics that have been used to, you know, gain eyeballs may have affected some New Yorkers. And, you know, people don't want their apartment to catch on fire, right? So they're like, hey, you know, I like e-biking. I like to charge in my apartment. Should I buy this, you know, battery off Alibaba right now? Or should I maybe think about getting a battery that's maybe a little bit more expensive, but not going to burn my house down? So I think maybe that those scare tactics that we don't, you know, we know the numbers don't add up, like report other deaths equally, may have rubbed off on, you know, some New Yorkers. I know me personally, like, I don't want a cheap bike battery charging anywhere near my, you know, where I sleep. So, you know, like for instance, when we get things to review that I, you know, maybe I don't think are super safe, I charge them in our barn. So, you know, that thing can burn down and, you know, thank God. You know, for my thing, I think all the things that you mentioned are definitely parts of it, but I think there's also the part where people don't want a, you know, a basically a bomb in their house that may, you know, catch on fire in the middle of the night. And the fact that the press has been very vocal about these fires, and New York has been, you know, to their credit, they've been like ahead of the, and I'm saying ahead of the U.S., you know, the rest of the U.S. and kind of getting ahead of battery fires. We did talk to battery expert Luke Powell. Is that his last name?
Workhorse.
And he mentioned
Workman.
Yeah, that yes. Workhorse is a
the EV brand.
Yeah, they all run together. He did mention that New York City is kind of the perfect storm of salt water because of the salt on the roads, the vapor getting into batteries and stuff like that. So New York is kind of in a bad place to begin with, but they did, to their credit, get kind of, I don't want to say ahead of it, but they kind of moved forward on making the batteries a little bit or a lot more safe. And then, you know, as I was saying, I think also it's people don't want a fire hazard where they sleep or where their kids are sleeping. So push and pull. Good to see it regardless. Definitely. Right?
Definitely.
All right. And we have some questions and comments in the comments section. So if you guys have anything else to say that we'll address after this last post, please do it now. And our final story of the week is electric scooter giant Gogoro cleared of fraud charges after investigation.
Yeah. So speaking of sort of charging on the street, if you're not familiar, Gogoro is basically the world leader in battery swapping, mostly for electric scooters, mopeds, and light electric motorcycles. These are bigger batteries. They're around twice the capacity, maybe a little bit more than the average electric bicycle battery. But their system is designed to work with, you know, thousands and thousands, I mean, actually millions of these distributed batteries all over whatever market that they operate in. And so they've been quite successful at expanding the company, but they've run into some, I don't know if financial issues is the right term, but they've had a few struggling quarters trying to make this system profitable. At the same time, just a few weeks ago, they were accused of potential subsidy fraud in their domestic market of Taiwan, because apparently there was a component of one of their scooter models that was not produced locally. I believe it was claimed that it came from China, yet the company was receiving subsidies from the Taiwanese government for having like purely domestic manufacturing, or achieving a certain percentage of domestic manufacturing, at least of all the major components in these. And so at the time the CEO stepped down, the company admitted that there was an anomaly in their supply chain, that they unintentionally used one of these foreign components. But we just heard a few days ago that after a government review, they were cleared of any purposeful wrongdoing, that essentially this was an accident. Now, it turns out this is actually related to a former investigation. It appears this might have happened more than once. So it does appear this is on a separate model than the case that we just learned about a couple weeks ago. But basically, the government said that there isn't any evidence, or there isn't sufficient evidence to say that the company was actually trying to, you know, pull the wool over the government's eyes here, and that it does appear to have been a sort of a record keeping mistake on parts acquisition. It was also one component on just a portion of a single model that the company makes, and they make many, many models of these scooters. So it might have been kind of overblown when it got picked up as, you know, this like big fraud thing, when really it was just sort of like a record keeping mistake. We are still waiting on the results of what's probably a second investigation to learn more, but it seems like it could have been another similar situation here. So on the one hand, like, obviously you want to know that a big company like this knows where all of their stuff is coming from, but it does seem like it was more of a record keeping issue. And it's good to see that this might not have been the, you know, the big scandal that, I think some in the press were making this out to be, especially because, at least for me, I'm really positive on what Gogoro is doing, because I just think it's such an incredible system, especially when you add in the issue of people, you know, needing to be able to charge batteries at home and the safety, that sort of thing, that because you've got all these distributed chargers outdoors, it just makes the system that much safer. I've never heard of a Gogoro fire, and they've got, I think they're coming on close to 2 million batteries produced. So, you know, they build these things really well, and I don't think that that's an issue, but it also means that someone who's using the Gogoro system doesn't have to rely on a, you know, cheaper, inferior quality battery that they're charging at home under their bed, sort of thing. So I'm glad to see that Gogoro is probably, you know, clear in this situation. It's unfortunate that the CEO had to step down, but it's starting to look like that might have been more related to the financial, you know, performance of the company in the last few quarters than any potential, like, nefarious fraud issues, which don't seem to be the case.
Well, I was just going to ask, is there a possibility that he could be reinstated after clearing his, or is this kind of water under the bridge there?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it seems like a, you know, a big matzo ball hanging out there to go back on, so to speak. Right. And it does, like, at this point, you know, like I said, I think it's probably more related to, you know, what might have been questions about leadership direction that would have led to, you know, some several million dollar losses over the last few quarters when the company is trying to prove a profitable model here, as opposed to being more related to this potential fraud investigation.
Yeah, I mean, still sad to see. Like, it's always, you know, it kind of feels like when a founder leaves a company, it's always like a little bit questionable how they're going to do and what direction they're going to go. And especially Gogoro is such a kind of important company, I think, especially as we, you know, move forward in like this new world of mobility. So I guess we'll keep an eye there. It is good that they're kind of being cleared at least of these initial charges. All right.
Absolutely.
Let's move into questions. We got quite a few, but there's still time to ask if you guys have any questions. Extra Hero says, could you guys make the show weekly, or would that be too expensive? Well, it's not really that expensive to make the show, but just, you know, the amount of e-bike news versus car news in general is a little bit lower. So we kind of feel like the perfect thing is bi-weekly, but we're open to it. Maybe we get some more information, or I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, as the industry continues to grow, maybe at some point it is like, wow, you know, there's so much stuff in the past 2 weeks. We gotta adapt. But yeah, at this point, I mean, I see, you know, how much you guys have to talk about on the car electric podcast, and it's, you know, the industries aren't quite at the same level of maturity.
Not quite, no. All right, Extra Hero, did you guys see that the electric Expedition now comes in colors? Not as impressive as the Hay Bike Haulers colors, but it's good to see something other than white. I feel like we knew that, but maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, they were described, I believe, as a limited edition, and I think are actually already sold out, which on the one hand shows that they were probably pretty popular, but I'm not sure if it's something that's going to stick around or not. Some companies use limited edition to test the waters.
Right.
So if they sold out pretty quickly, then maybe electric realizes that, you know, it's something people want. You know, in several of my conversations with Levi, it's pretty obvious that for their model to work as well as it does, they have to be careful with this like SKU proliferation where, you know, you end up with like 1,000 different products.
Right.
And so I think that's what's limited them to not come out with too many different color variations on each bike, because it helps them to stay more efficient and, yep, and agile, and not stock, you know, literally dozens of unique e-bike models. So I'm not sure if they're set up yet to have that many colors, but I would love to see it, because that's the one thing that they're they're really missing compared to a lot of these other companies that have just such cool, fun e-bike colorway options to choose from.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. Electric scooters are easy to use and eco-friendly. Thank you, Facebook. Will we ever see a budget version of the Urban Aero style e-bike? I'm trying to think what's the least expensive like bucket bike that I've ever seen. And they're all high end and you kind of want them to be high end, right? Like you don't want to throw your kids in a bucket that's going to fall off the side or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, so I'm trying to think like, what is the thing that makes those jump up so much in price? And I think sort of like Tadpole trikes, it's the steering mechanism being so unique and complicated that they don't get to take advantage of economies of scale in the same way, because there are a bunch of unique parts to that. And so, and that's kind of a, you know, a niche bike design. So they're not, you know, filling up bike shops with those things. And so both of those really bump the price. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's, I mean, you're shipping a refrigerator box at that point almost.
Basically, yeah.
And so, yeah, I think the 10 ways one might've been the cheapest. I forget how much it was. I want to say maybe like $5,000. Don't quote me on that. Up 10 ways front loader. I think that might've been the closest to budget so far.
You know, I saw a couple, I don't know if they were Urban Aeros or, which, but I saw a few at Upway. That's that, kind of bicycle, refurbisher in Brooklyn and also in Europe. And I feel like they were starting at a lower price point. So, I mean, maybe that's an option if you're budget constrained and you need something like that. And the thing is, like, you know, these are for small kids and your kids are only small for a few years. So there's going to be a secondary market for these things. Definitely. So maybe that's the way to go. Maybe that's where you find your lower priced ones. Cargo bike mama has been safely riding around New York with her babies and her Urban Aero since before 2020. More power to her. Good for her. I think that's really great. A great person for y'all to interview is Chris Nolte, friend of the show. We both love Chris. With the Propel Bike Channel, runs a cargo bike store in New York and has started a new company to produce e-bikes in the U.S. We should dial up Chris. We haven't talked to him in a while. He also has a store in Long Beach, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, I'm overdue for a call with Chris. We see eye to eye on a lot of things. What are your all's thoughts on EVgo charging getting the $1 billion from the Department of Energy and Exro Technologies nominated for Stellantis Supplier of the Year Innovative Motor Control Technology? Well, I think EVgo is more of a car charging thing, so maybe wait for the evening podcast on that one. We'll be around at 4 o'clock Eastern.
Explains why I'm so ignorant about them. That's good.
Is it odd that Rad has still not come out with a single dual battery e-bike? I guess all their bikes are dual battery because you can just buy another battery and put them on there, right?
Yeah, but it's not like the Electric Expedition where there's a second port where if you wanted to run two at once, you know, you don't have to stop and swap out batteries sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess Rad is kind of simplicity is their one of their things. They're not really going to have like a dual battery controller.
Yeah, I mean, Rad is rarely, maybe that's not fair. I was going to say they've rarely like been the first mover on things, which is not true because they have a few times, but they've also definitely waited out some common additions to the industry. It took them forever to adopt hydraulic brakes, and there have been times where they've sort of like waited to watch to see the direction that other companies are gonna, if they're gonna commit to something. And so maybe, you know, we'll eventually see a dual battery e-bike. It wouldn't surprise me because Rad really likes upsell opportunities. You know, there's a lot of money in accessories, there's money in a second battery, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, even just a slot like to put like a bottle battery or something.
Yeah, some e-bikes have like a dummy slot where at least there's a place for it, and it might not be electrically connected, but it's mounted.
Right. All right. I've never seen an e-bike promoted more on YouTube than Engway. So many reviewers and non-reviewers are sent their bikes. Yes, they are very aggressive with that. That seems to be their marketing way to go, which is good. Like, you know, YouTubers are good at reviewing stuff, and We're no different. On Gogoro, got a great review from MIT. I think e-bikes and scooters, maybe even motorcycles, should have swappable batteries. Yeah, we've talked about in the past, like, could Gogoro be used as a e-bike battery? They're just a little bit boxier. Like, you would have to kind of, I don't know where exactly you would put that on an e-bike, but it would be kind of interesting to see if that would be possible. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I actually talked about that a little bit with Horace when I was there in Taiwan earlier this year, just sort of in passing. And what he said was that, like, technologically, it would be super easy. Really, it's just the packaging that's the issue, because they make the receptacle that allows other companies to basically receive the signal from the battery, talk to it, and, you know, they make it as easy as possible for other companies to build around their battery, because that's really their business model. They don't just want to sell scooters. They want to provide a battery as a service. And so, like, it would be possible, but it's this weird shape to fit on a bike. It's very, like, wide, you know, it's like a cuboid, an elongated cuboid, I guess.
Yeah.
Rectangular prism. That's it.
Okay. Did we ever get this specialized, the Globe Hall?
No, my I had a PR guy there, but he left, so I need to get a new connection at Specialized and see if they'll let me borrow a haul, because, yeah, that's a very interesting bike that I would love to try.
Or maybe we'll send one up to you. Yeah, I saw that at a local bike store. Looks like a great bike.
Yeah.
Beam solar chargers are pretty cool, too. I've seen a local government adopt them in my area, so I'm assuming that's like the solar charger we talked about. Have you heard of Beam?
Yes. Yeah, that's the one we talked about. I think they're, I think they had car chargers, which I don't know if that's what you're talking about, inner, but, I know they've rolled out, I think, solar powered car chargers before. I don't know if they've done bike chargers yet.
Okay.
Other than the ones that they just unveiled a few days ago in the rendering.
Gotcha. Where in the US might be the best location to adopt Gogoro scooters and battery swapping? I'm a big fan as well. New York obviously would be a place, right?
Yeah, in New York. But I think Southern California would probably be the only other place where there would be enough riders to even get close. First of all, there's nowhere good in the US for it yet. Let's start with that. We're talking about the best of not great options, not because it's not a good solution, but because it's not a problem that needs to be solved in the US yet. The ridership is just not big enough in the motorcycle community for there to be enough electric scooter riders out there that are like, where am I going to charge this thing? You know, in Indonesia, where everybody is on a motorbike, it's different. But in the US, it's just the density of riders is not high enough to make it work yet. But I think, you know, Southern California, where it's all year riding weather and there actually are motorcycle riders and you get the benefit of lane splitting and that sort of thing, I think that would probably be the place to start.
Yep. All right. Thanks for the info. And this podcast is mostly about e-bikes and other small electric vehicles. We sometimes cover small four-wheel vehicles, neighborhood electric vehicle type things, and green energy and stuff like that, but mostly e-bikes. That's all for the questions. And,
awesome. Well, we're glad to have you all. Thank you, those of you who joined in the comments, and to everybody else at home on the way to work or wherever you've been watching. I will be glad to have you back here in another 2 weeks for the next episode of the Wheelie Podcast. See you next time, everyone.